Okay, so that's a little bit about faith and inquiry. Yeah, just to summarize, you know, that Buddhism really encourages us to ask questions and to deepen our understanding because it respects us as intelligent living beings, you know. So we're taught to verify things by our own experience, verify things by logical understanding, and see if they really make sense and can help us. Okay? So we are not encouraged to have blind belief because blind belief doesn't lead us to enlightenment. It doesn't deepen the level of our understanding one iota. Okay? So that means that we have to do some work to gain this deeper understanding that increases our trust and confidence, that in turn makes us more open-minded and able to understand the scriptures. Okay? So now I'll open up to questions and answers. I think there's some mics that you can ask, or you can write your questions down.
Hi, Venerable. Good evening to you. I have a few questions. My grandmother passed away 2 weeks ago. I dream about her a few times. The first question, do dreams mean anything in Buddhism? Is she trying to tell me something? The second question is, I was told to chant the Amitabha Sutra for 49 days on the day of her passing. What can I do for her after 49 days? And lastly, I have a request, which is for you, Venerable, to pray for my grandmother. Her name is Kwek Gyok Lan. Thank you.
Okay. Sure, of course, I'll pray for your grandma. Okay, so the question is about, the first question, do dreams mean anything? it's really cute. In the Tibetan system, sometimes before we take a different initiation, so we have different ceremonies, our teacher may instruct us to watch our dreams. So everybody gets very excited. Oh, our teacher said to watch our dreams. So we all, you know, lie down and we, you know, try and watch our dreams. And then the next day we're all, oh, what did you dream? And what did you dream? And what did you, and oh, I dreamt this. And what did you dream? And we get so excited about our dreams and we're waiting to hear what our teacher's going to say about our dreams. And the first thing our teacher says is, they are only dreams. And all of our excitement and all of our hype just, you know. Yeah. So dreams are only dreams, okay? Some of our dreams arise because of situations that happened to us in our life. We can tell that often. Last night I dreamt about strawberries, and I think it's because I ate strawberries yesterday. Okay. So, dreams come about in that way. They say that sometimes dreams can indicate things about the future, but we have to know how to properly interpret them in that case. Yeah. And sometimes dreams are can be influenced by our physical body. You know, if we're ill, if we have a fever, we have certain kind of dreams. If we're very weak, we have other kinds of dreams. So actually, the best way that we use dreams in from a Buddhist viewpoint is as an analogy with how things appear to exist in one way, but actually exist in another way. Okay? Because when we're dreaming, the dream object appears very real. In the middle of a dream, you know, we think we're living reality and we take everything very seriously. Only when we wake up do we realize that the thing we dreamt about didn't exist. Okay, all those strawberries I dreamt about last night, and they were special strawberries. Yeah. Some of them gave you this realization, some of you gave you that realization. None of those strawberries exist. Okay. So the whole idea of a dream is that something appears to exist in a real way, but it doesn't exist. It's only a dream object. Okay. So similarly, in our everyday life, things appear to be inherently existent. They appear to have their own nature, their own thingness, their own essence. But in actual fact, things don't have their own independent nature. Everything is interdependent. Everything exists dependent on other factors. So that appearance that we have of things being independent is a false appearance, in the same way that when we're dreaming, those dream objects are false appearances. So we use dreams as an analogy for understanding emptiness, that things appear but they don't exist in the way that they appear. Okay. So that's the answer to your first question. The second question about how to help your grandma after the 49 days, I think it can be very useful if you have some of her possessions to make charity with those possessions, make offerings on her behalf, either from her funds or, you know, offer her clothing or some of her possessions to a charity. So in that way, you use her belongings to create the positive potential or the merit of generosity, and then dedicate all that positive potential so that she will have a good rebirth. And so it's very important, you know, when you're related to somebody and you have a close connection with somebody like that, that you create the merit and do the dedication prayers, because you're the one with the strongest karmic connection with them. And so really, you know, dedicate, you know, may she be reborn at, either in the Pure Lands or with a precious human life. May she meet fully qualified Mahayana teachers. May she recognize those teachers and take the Dharma to heart and generate confidence in the Buddha's teachings that's based on inquiry and understanding. May she become a fully enlightened Buddha. So you make these kind of dedication prayers. Okay. Other questions? There's one written here. Okay, so there's two questions here. One is it possible to arrange our destiny or the fate of this lifetime by doing more positive actions? Okay. I want to speak a little bit about these words, fate and destiny. Okay? Because from a Buddhist perspective, there's no such thing as fate. Okay? From a Buddhist perspective, there's no such thing as predestination. Yeah. Rather, things arise due to causes and conditions. They don't arise independently, so there's not chaos. It's not that things arise with no cause. Things arise due to causes and conditions, but they aren't fixed and concrete and predestined and fated. Okay. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama always says, we never know the future until it happens. Okay? That means that if you change any of the causes, if you change any of the conditions, what the result is going to be is going to change. Yeah? So one cause may kind of be going along as if it's going to ripen, but then if you change a condition, that cause has no opportunity to ripen. So, for example, this is one of the big reasons not to take intoxicants. Okay? Because if you take intoxicants, you're creating the cooperative conditions for negative karma to ripen. Okay? So we may have done created negative actions in a previous life, and have those seeds on our mind stream. Those seeds are the principal condition Okay? So those negative karmic seeds are on our mind stream. If we go out and get drunk or we, you know, abuse drugs, then we're creating the circumstances for the seeds of those negative actions to arise and to grow. Okay? So for example, if you drink and drive, we're creating the causes for negative karma to ripen and get in an accident. You know, if we don't drink and drive, we're even if that karma is there, it's not going to be able to ripen at that time because we haven't gotten drunk, so we're not driving recklessly. Okay? So things are not fated and predestined, and so always there's flexibility in how karma ripens. Our negative karmas can be inhibited from ripening, and they can be completely eradicated eventually, but we have to exert some effort. You know, the retreat that we're doing tomorrow and the next day is a purification retreat, and that's going to center around how to purify our negative karmic seeds, okay, so that these seeds don't ripen in our suffering experiences. Yeah. So there's always some kind of flexibility there in how karma ripens. Things are not fated or predestined. Okay. Having said that, once a karma ripens, you can't make it unripen. Okay? So for example, you know, what it's like once you break your leg, you can't unbreak it. Yeah, you have to deal with the situation of the broken leg. But of course, you can take care so that you don't hurt it even more. And you can take care so that you get it repaired. So similarly, you know, karma ripens and we might do something to increase that result or decrease that result. Okay, but we can't undo it. And there was another question here. Besides meditation, is there any other way to learn or to gain mindfulness? Well, meditation is one of the principal ways to develop mindfulness, but also slowing down our life is a very good way. Yeah. So if we slow down our life and become more aware of what we're saying, thinking, feeling, and doing, we become more mindful. Actually, mindfulness has different meanings in different Buddhist traditions. In some traditions, it means just be aware of what you're thinking, feeling, saying, and doing. In other traditions, for example, in the Tibetan tradition, mindfulness has the connotation in our daily life of being mindful of our precepts, being mindful of the altruistic intention of bodhicitta, being mindful of our ethical values. Okay? So it means holding in mind the good qualities that we want to make active in our life. Okay? So simply by training ourselves in constantly remembering these good qualities, that's another way to make ourselves mindful of them. Hello.
Good evening to you.
Where are you?
I'm over here, on your right hand side.
Behind that bright light, yes.
Yes. Good evening to you, Venerable Boss. Now, question I want to ask you about, you say we should put faith and trust in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a bit more on the trust and the faith in these three jewels?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand clearly.
Okay, you mentioned earlier about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Mm-hmm. The three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
Yeah.
How should we practice to have faith in these three jewels?
Oh, how should we practice
yes.
in relationship to Buddha, Dharma,
yes.
and Sangha?
And the other thing is, what's the importance of seeking refuge in the three jewels?
Okay, what's the importance? Okay, thank you. Okay, how do we practice in relationship to the three jewels? So an analogy is often given of we are like somebody who's sick. We're the patient, yeah? And our disease is called cyclic existence, yeah? And when we're suffering with this disease called cyclic existence, we have to go to a doctor who diagnoses our illness and who is able to tell us the cause of our illness. So the Buddha is like the doctor. He diagnoses and says, you're suffering from cyclic existence. And the causes of cyclic existence are ignorance, anger, and clinging attachment. Okay? So the Buddha diagnoses and the Buddha prescribes medicine. So based on knowing what the causes are, then the Buddha describes the wisdom realizing emptiness and love and compassion as antidotes to ignorance, anger, and attachment, which are like the viruses that are causing our illness. Okay? So the medicine that the Buddha prescribes is the Dharma. Okay? The Dharma is the wisdom that realizes emptiness. The Dharma is the altruistic intention and the compassionate heart. The Dharma is the determination to be free of cyclic existence. So that's the Dharma. Okay? Then, we've got our prescription. Yeah? We have the medicine that the doctor gave us. But you know, sometimes when you get home, you forget how to take the medicine. It's like, wait a minute, are there 3 green pills in the morning and 2 blue ones in the afternoon and 4 red ones in the evening? Or do I take the red ones in the morning and then the pink ones in the afternoon and then a few blue ones and green ones together? And you know, we forget, we get confused. So we need a nurse. Yeah? And we need a nurse so that we take the medicine. And also because sometimes we're a little squeamish when we take the medicine. You know, we can't swallow the pills whole. So we need somebody to grind it up and mix it in with applesauce. Yeah? Like our grandma used to do and our mom used to do. So we need nurses for that purpose. So the Sangha are like nurses. The Sangha help us take the Dharma medicine. Okay? They encourage us. They set a good example. They remind us how to practice. Okay? So that's, I think, a very good way to relate to the Buddha Dharma Sangha in terms of how we practice with them. It's very interesting. I was mentioning this 3-month retreat we did at the Abbey. There was one young man there who has been studying Buddhism for many years, even in the university. And he had heard this whole analogy many times, you know? We're the patient, Buddha's the doctor, Dharma's the medicine, Sangha's the nurse. But he said his big realization during the retreat was he actually got it that he was the patient, you know? He actually got it that he was sick. And that he needed some medicine and he needed a doctor and he needed the nurses. Okay? So very often, you know, really this is what we, you know, we're blind to our own illness. Or we know it on the level of words, but we don't really live our life like that. Okay? And then your second question was, what's the importance of taking refuge? There's a refuge ceremony that we do that is usually given by a monastic, and there's a simple version in which we basically repeat the three refuges after our teacher. The purpose of doing this is that it really links us to the whole continuity of teachers and practitioners going all the way back to the Buddha. Okay? So we took refuge, you know, in a public ceremony in the presence of our teacher. We're connecting to that whole lineage of practitioners going back to the Buddha. Because our teacher took refuge from their teacher, who took refuge from their teacher, who took refuge from their teacher, all the way back to the Buddha when he first gave refuge to his disciples. So when we take refuge in a ceremony, we're joining in that lineage. We're tapping into that cumulative energy that's gone from generation to generation. Also, when we take refuge in a public ceremony, we're making a public commitment. And it's like the difference between living with somebody and marrying them. Yeah, you can love them and live with them, but when you get married, something changes because you've made a commitment in a public way. So similarly, you know, when we take refuge, you know, we're making a public commitment, and so our relationship with the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha changes, and it becomes much tighter, much closer. Yeah. Now, having said that, we initially take refuge in a ceremony, but then our refuge increases and develops over time. Yeah, because I know for myself, when I first took refuge in 1975, I had the understanding of a baby in terms of Buddhism. Now I have the understanding of a 2-year-old. Okay, so there's some improvement. Yeah, so our way of taking refuge is like one of those light switches. It's not the on and off light switch, but it's the one that dials. Yeah. So in that way, you know, your refuge starts out small, and then it keeps turning, because as you practice more, your connection to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha really deepens in quite a profound way, and your trust and confidence and feeling of connection with them deepens. And so your refuge deepens as well. And I think this continues on and on and on until we are at the point where our mind actually becomes the refuge. Our mind becomes the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, so the question is, are Christians included in the cycle of rebirth? Okay. If they are, they're of a different religion, and so they don't know our teachings, and will this be a disadvantage to them? So, yes, everybody's included in the cycle of rebirth. It's not that you only get reborn if you believe in rebirth. You know, you get reborn simply because of cause and effect. It's kind of like, what's a good example? Rat poisoning will kill you whether you have faith in it or not. Whether you know something is rat poisoning or not, it'll still kill you. Whether you believe it will kill you or not, it still will. So similarly, you know, all sentient beings are subject to rebirth when their minds are influenced by ignorance, anger, and attachment. So it doesn't matter what religion they are. We're all subject to rebirth. Now, having said that, you know, where we're reborn depends a lot on our karma. And it's not the cumulative effect of our karma. It's not negative and positive on a scale and they all weigh out. But it's more the example of a field with many, many seeds in it. And depending on which seeds are watered, those seeds will be the ones that grow. Okay? So some seeds may grow and cause us to be born in one situation in this life, and then other seeds may be watered and influence what we become on the next life, and other seeds the life after that. Okay, so depending on what seeds are watered, those are the seeds that will grow. Okay, so what the water is the kind of thought that we have at the time of death. Yeah, and so if we're able to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha at the time of death, then there's no way that we will have an unfortunate rebirth. If we're angry and upset at the time of death, that causes negative karma to ripen. So in that way, being a Buddhist and training our life in the Buddha's teachings enables us to take rebirth to take refuge at the time of death, and it provides that protection that will hopefully enable us to have a good rebirth. Okay? That doesn't mean that people of other religions all have bad rebirths. That's not the case, because somebody can live an ethical life but as a member of another religion. Or they may have created good karma in a life before this one, and that good karma could still, ripen. So Buddhism does not say that you have to be a Buddhist in order to have a good rebirth and that you're going to hell if you aren't a Buddhist. Okay? That's not a Buddhist belief in any, way at all. Of course, it helps to be a Buddhist because then you know the teachings and you abandon negative actions. You try and apply the antidotes to ignorance, anger, and attachment to your own mind. So it definitely benefits. Okay? All religions are designed to help people. So even if they have different beliefs than we do, still the part of those religions that teach ethical concern, that teach loving kindness, those are good parts of those religions. And if people practice those parts of those religions, then they'll create some good karma that will be of benefit to them. Okay.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Venerable. Okay. Good evening to you.
Where are you? Because I can't see with the light. Okay. Thank you.
So sorry. Just to check with you, I saw some yellow, that is a pink brochure on the reception counter there. Mm-hmm. Can I know more about it? And there's I saw something like me, 12, there's a prayer. What prayer is that, and how much do I have to pay for it?
You don't have to pay anything. Yeah. People who like to, they can make offerings to the Abbey, and then through the process of making offerings, you create positive potential. And then the people who live at the Abbey, through our practice, we dedicate to the people who are our benefactors. And so then we make prayers. So on May 12th, we'll be doing puja. Puja is like a ritual or a ceremony. It's called the Guru Puja or the Lama Chopa. And it's one in which we take refuge, we generate bodhicitta, we do prostrations and make offerings and confession, and rejoice at the goodness of others and ourselves, and request the Buddhas to remain and to teach the Dharma. There's also verses that go through all the different Dharma teachings, kind of synthesizing the whole path to enlightenment. So this puja is very comprehensive in terms of it really talks about a lot of different virtuous states of mind. So that's the one that we'll be doing on May 12th. And then we dedicate it for everybody who asks us to, and then especially for those people who are our benefactors and who enable us to live. Because as a monastic community, we live our lives freely. I mean, you have tremendous freedom as a monastic because you don't charge for anything. You just give. You know, your life is a life of generosity, but then you count on other people to hopefully see some value in your life and want to help you continue to live. Okay, so you count on other people providing food, medicine, clothing, and shelter. And then through this dependent relationship, everybody benefits, because the people who support practitioners benefit by creating good karma, which the people they benefact dedicate for them, and which they can also dedicate themselves. And then the monastics, who are depending on the kindness of others to live, create good karma through giving the Dharma. So it's this interdependent situation of, providing the Dharma and providing material needs. And it goes back and forth like that. And in that way, everybody benefits. Okay, so that's why at Srivasti Abbey we don't charge for everything. Everything is freely given. Because even if people come to stay with us, we don't charge, because then it becomes business and nobody creates any merit. But if we just give and then other people give to us, then everybody creates merit. And so we have a custom at the Abbey that we only eat food that is donated to us. We don't go out and buy food. Yeah. So when I first set the Abbey up like this, it was with the intention to go back to the way in which the Buddha initially set it up. I mean, we can't go on alms round because where we live, there's no people around, or very few who could feed us. But still, you know, the basic principle is to be dependent on others for food, and so that's why we only eat the food that people bring to the Abbey. Some people live far away, so they can't bring the food to the Abbey, so they send some money to people who live nearby who buy the groceries and bring it to the Abbey. But in that way, you know, it really enhances your own spiritual practice, because every time you eat anything, you know, it's really strong in your mind. I'm eating this only because of the kindness of others. So therefore, I have a very strong obligation to practice the Dharma in a pure way so that I can really benefit these people who are offering me the food, clothing, shelter, and medicine and enabling me to stay alive. So it becomes a very profound practice from the side of the recipients, from the side of the givers. It creates a tremendous sense of joy in knowing that, wow, there's people in the world who are meditating on wisdom and compassion, and I'm keeping them alive. You know, I'm building a house where they can live, or a temple where they can practice. So it brings a big sense of joy in that way. So everybody creates merit in that schema. So that's the idea behind the prayers that we're going to be doing on May 12th. Thank you. So I think we have to stop now. Yeah? Before we stop, let's just sit quietly, okay, and do our own dedication. My apologies to everybody whose questions I didn't answer. There were still a lot of questions from last night. I know that there's more tonight, so my apologies. Okay? But let's come back to our kind heart and rejoice that we were able to spend the evening together thinking about faith, trust, confidence, and inquiry. Let's rejoice that we were able to deepen our trust in the Buddha's teachings merely through appreciating the fact that they encourage us to think and examine. Let's appreciate that we met the Buddha's teachings to start with, that we have access to teachers and spiritual friends, Dharma friends, who encourage us along the path. And let's dedicate all the positive potential that we and others have created in the past, the present, and the future. So think of all the goodness in the world, the goodness of ordinary beings, the goodness of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Arhats. And let's send that out into the universe together with our prayers and aspirations, so that everybody can learn the Buddha's teachings and gain deep trust and confidence in them that comes from their own experience and from applying reasoning. Let's dedicate so that we always meet qualified teachers who will teach us the correct view, and that we have the intelligence to think about their teachings and gain conviction in them. Let's dedicate so that through our understanding of the Buddha's teachings, our wisdom and compassion grow, and so that we really reach out to be of greater service and more extensive benefit to all other living beings. Let's dedicate so that every living being can live can be at peace in their own heart and live peacefully with others. And finally, let's dedicate so that everybody may quickly become a fully enlightened Buddha and be of the greatest benefit to all others and have the highest joy, the highest wisdom. Okay. So thank you all very much. You've been a wonderful audience. And please try and put the teachings into practice. Remember them and put them into practice so that they help your lives, so that they make you a kinder person, so that they help relieve the stress from anger and wrong views and jealousy and clinging. So really use the Buddha's teachings as medicine to help the state of your mind. Because if you use them, they work. If you just keep the medicine, if you have lots of bottles of medicine on the shelves in your room but you don't take any of it, you're not going to get well. So you might have a lot of Dharma books or listen to a lot of teachings, but if you don't practice, you know, then cyclic existence isn't going to end. So really try and put the teachings into practice. So thank you.